Today's subject seems perfectly suited for a Please Explain segment. It's familiar, part of daily life, but not well understood by most of us. After all, how many of us give more than a moment's thought to the nature of the dirt or soil under our feet? And yet it's essential to life on Earth. To help us understand the wonderful complexities of soil, we have invited to our show Mike Wilson, research soil scientist with the United States Department of Agriculture, Natural Resources Conservation Service, the National Soil Survey Center in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Chris Smith, National Leader for Technical Soil Services with the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service in Washington, D.C. Welcome to our show.
Hello, how are you?
Thank you.
Can't you people work for places that have shorter names?
It's the government.
Is there a basic working definition of soil that all scientists share, Chris?
Well, yeah, there is, and I was thinking you'd probably be asking that, and I won't read the entire definition, but basically you can think of it as unconsolidated mineral and organic matter on the immediate surface of the earth. It serves as a natural medium for the growth of land plants.
So, Mike, is soil the same thing as earth or dirt or loam?
Yeah, I would say it's just different definitions for it. Specifically, everybody cringes when you say the word dirt amongst soil scientists, but you could just basically think of it as the fact that dirt is soil out of place, like a plant is a weed where you don't want it. So you can call it what you want.
Well, we say earth when we're not – we say soil usually when we're talking about something will grow plant in, but earth is kind of like what's underfoot, and dirt is what we get on our hands.
Correct, yeah, and soil composes both.
There are many different ways to come at the subject of soil, as I understand it. One could study the physics of soil, its chemistry, its biology. Can I ask both of you to give us a sense of your special areas of interest? First you, Mike.
I work in the area of chemistry and mineralogy of soils and basically how these basic sciences influence the soil properties. And I guess I got interested in soil science as a student because I took a lot of the basic chemistry and physics courses and didn't really see an application until I took soils. And immediately you get a sense that there is a reason to study chemistry. And so I kind of caught fire in terms of my interest. And today, I perform different kinds of research projects amongst my other duties. One thing I'm involved with fairly heavily is just looking at the geochemistry of soil or trace element content. And so we've done a lot of work on that in terms of some of our samples that we collect as part of the soil survey program. Then we're looking at the natural distribution of these elements. And we're also looking at just the distribution of soils on landscapes. We have a project in southern Illinois, Indiana, and Kentucky, understanding basically the movement of water and how it influences the properties of soil.
And later we'll get into all the different kinds of soil. Well, we won't get into all of them because I understand there are 250,000 different types of soil. What about you, Chris?
Well, I got interested in soils. I went to Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, California, and I was looking for a major, and the soil science major had such a diversity of courses. And then when I got in the first soil course, I realized that it was a very complex topic, incorporating chemistry and physics, as Mike was talking about, and biology. And I thought, wow, this is really a great integrator. And then I started learning about how soils formed out of doors and realizing that actually looking at soil profiles and landscapes tells you a history of the earth. It's like reading a book. And so, one thing led to another, and here I am.
Black Elk once said, "Give me strength to walk the soft earth, a relative to all that is." Was that an accurate thought on his part? I throw this out to both of you.
Well, yeah, I guess that would be. I would say that's a pretty good statement, especially for somebody who probably appreciated the soil.
Well, I've heard soil described in such a way as to make me think of it as almost a skin over the planet. Is that a way to think of it?
I think that we use that analogy a lot, and I think it's true. And it's definitely a living thing. Your soul scientists will say that if you took all of the mineral material out of a soil, you could still see the outline of the soil by all of the living organisms that are left there.
Hmm.
That's how rich it is.
Well, maybe we can talk to the types of soil by looking at how different kinds of soil are formed. What is the process of the formation of soil?
Well, I guess, if you want to start at some of the basic things is you have some sort of sediment or geologic material that begins the weathering process, and this could be either a physical breakdown through freezing and thawing or a chemical breakdown of these particles, which then release the elements within the soil, which those elements can function as plant nutrients. Then plants begin to have the capability of growing on this material that's been broken down and with the nutrients supplied, providing the organic constituents then as the plants live and die. And then as that process continues on, you start having different chemical changes occurring in the soil where you can solubilize some of these rock materials and as well as moving some particles from the surface of the soil down into the subsoil. And that whole process then creates the horizons that we know, the surface horizon, the A horizon is the organic rich horizon, and then we start forming B horizons, the subsoil horizons that basically are the accumulators of some of these translocated particles as well as where some of these soluble constituents precipitate. And that's a process that occurs as soils age, that we start with fairly young soils or entosols, and they have very little differentiation of horizons. And then I always think of that we form teenage soils or inceptosols, and those have the weakly developed subsoil horizons that they you start to see some differentiation occurring. And then finally, you hit the more mature soils, the alphasols and mollisols and such, and as soils, depending on the nature of the parent material and the landscape and the stability of the landscape, they can grow old, and some are older soils are ultisols and oxisols that have occurred on fairly stable landscapes, so these processes have continued for thousands of years.
And we wind up with 12 different soil orders, don't we?
Yes.
At the top, I guess, are the gallosols and the histosols. What are they?
The gelosols, actually it's gelosols.
Gelosols, okay.
And though that's a fairly new soil order in our classification system, but it's a very important one, and it's regarding the permafrost soils, the frozen soils. And the reason those soils are so important is that as climate warms, these soils are thawing, and researchers are finding that they're liberating significant quantities of carbon dioxide and methane, which, you know, is two greenhouse gases. So they're very important to understand in their processes.
My guests are Mike Wilson and Chris Smith. We're talking about soil on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What are the most plentiful types of soil on the planet?
Shall I do that one, Mike?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, Mike mentioned one of the soil orders is mollisols, and I think that certainly is a good contender for the most plentiful. And those are generally they're deep. In other words, a meter and a half, 2 meters or more deep. They have a thick, dark surface. It's darkened by organic matter. So they have reasonable contents of organic matter, and then they're also reasonably fertile.
Those are grassland soils?
And that's a really good example. Think of the prairies of the Midwest where the glaciers plowed a layer of till, you know, ground up rock down across the landscape, and then as they retreated, the winds blew and dust, or what we call lus, covered the landscape. And so those prairie soils are this lust-till-derived soil. So there's a lot of weatherable minerals still in them, and so they're very nutrient-rich.
We invite calls during these segments. Our number here is 212-433-9692. Also, comments on our show page at WNYC.org. And we've already gotten a call from Michael from Greenwich, Connecticut, who, Michael, is a geologist?
Am I on the line, sir?
Yes, you are.
Oh, good. Good afternoon. Thank you. My first career out of college was as a geologist. I worked for New Adria Mining Chemical, and later we did an exploration project on our own, and that leads me to my first of two questions, but I'd hardly say I'm a geologist anymore. Thank you, gentlemen. Here's my question. We had an idea back then, and we weren't able to do it, and I'm wondering if technically you think it would have any merit today, at least from the sampling technology perspective. We were looking for cinnabar, which is the ore, which is the mineral that, when it's retorted, gives you quicksilver or mercury, the liquid metal. It's volatile, and we had some evidence that mercury would halo on the soil surface. So as an exploration technique, we investigated soil sampling to see if we could detect anomalies, halos, and we thought that these halos might even, if we could detect them, be associated with other...
Michael, we have only a brief amount of time, and we have a lot of people going to call in, and there's a lot more to talk about. Can you get to the point, please?
Yes. The question is, would technologically today, 40 years later, do your guests think that would be possible to do, to run soil samples and to detect from those soil samples, be able to spectrograph out mercury and detect anomalous amounts. Mm-hmm. I have one other quick question.
I think that we're going to leave it at that, Michael. Can you answer his question?
Mike, sounds like your field more than mine.
Yeah, you know, as part of soil survey, we don't typically look at all the satellite imagery that might be available. But some of these things could possibly, you know, if you're looking at a large scale and trying to detect that, there is some equipment out there that could. Now, from our standpoint, the way we collect our soil samples and analyze them, we probably wouldn't pick up the anomalies that might have occurred unless we were targeting a certain geologic unit.
Can we get back to more basic things? What can we tell about soil from its smell and its feel?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, from the smell, I mean, you know, any gardener, any good gardener will sense a pleasant aroma of a healthy soil and one that is well drained. In other words, it's not waterlogged and smelling stagnant, if you will, or anaerobic. So, you know, you can sense a poorly drained, oxygen-deprived soil by the sense of smell. You can sense a rich, humus-laden, the smell of actually the organisms called actinomyces, the group of organisms that gives that sort of a yeasty, you know, compost-like aroma. So you can get a sense of things from the smell. And then the feel, that's very important, too, because soils will build little structural units, granules or small blocky units. When those are in great prevalence, then the root proliferation around and through the soil is easier. Water infiltration is easier. If soils are compacted, then they're massive and hard to break and that sort of thing. So smell and feel does actually play a big part in when we are out describing soils, mapping landscapes, and so on.
French farmers talk about the importance of terroir to the taste of what's being grown. Do scientists think that way as well?
Explain.
Well, terroir would be the microclimate, the whole thing. For example, they grow grapes in chalky soil because it's actually harder for the grapes to get a lot of nutrients. Is volcanic soil especially good for growing things because it has a lot of nutrients?
I think Mike and I will probably vie for that answer. You start, Mike.
Well, you know, I think a lot of volcanic soils could be good because of the fertility of them. They have a lot of other limitations in terms of their land use. But in terms of wine-producing areas, there is a real thrust right now in terms of using soil survey and soil science to better differentiate the types of soil. So there's a lot of interest in collaboration between the vineyards and soil surveys in specific areas of the country in New York, as well as I'm familiar with some out in Oregon, where they've been very interested in the properties of their soils and how they influence not only the productivity of the grapes, but also the quality of the grape that's produced.
Can I add a bit to that?
Sure.
Yeah, I was going to say that we have been talking about what properties we bring into play under, say, geographical information systems, soil and climate, et cetera, for the grapes. So it's a very interesting topic. But back on the andisols, they can be soup to nuts. They can be highly fertile and productive, or they can be highly acid and leached and rather problematic. I spent 18 years in Hawaii as the state soil scientist out there, and there's one soil that, they hold so much water just because of their mineralogical makeup that equipment will sink through the fields, and farmers try to dry them out over hundred years to change the property so they'll support the tractor better. And actually, they've been able to do that. But so it's a wide variety.
Does soil have an electric charge?
Yes, and most soils have a negative charge, so they're able to hold positively charged nutrients, like, let's say, like calcium, magnesium, potassium, that sort of thing. Some of the more highly weathered soils, like Mike was talking about earlier, and you can see them in the southeast Piedmont, the red soils of the Piedmont, and in the tropics, the oxisols, the red clayey soils, those soils have a component of positive charge to them as well. So that makes them stand out from the norm. They have and their charge varies. If the pH goes up, the charge is greater. If the pH goes down, the charge is less.
We have to take a little break, and we'll come back with more and take calls from our listeners. Our number here is 212-433-9692. But please don't call in and ask what soil would be best for growing your gladiolas in. The agency that my two guests are working for is 75 years old, started in response to the Dust Bowl years. Wow. They are Chris Smith, National Leader for Technical Soil Services with the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service in Washington, D.C., and Mike Wilson, Research Soil Scientist with the United States Department of Agriculture, Natural Resources Conservation Service, National Soils Survey Center in Lincoln, Nebraska. We'll be back with your calls and more questions after this. We're back with Chris Smith and Mike Wilson, both from the United States Department of Agriculture. We're talking about soil on today's Please Explain. And before we get to our callers at 212-433-9692, what's man-made soil, and how is it made?
Well, there's quite a few different examples, especially around the New York area, of basically human-altered soils or human-transported soils. And when we think about them, they vary from mine spoils to dredged materials, materials that have been dredged out of some of the estuaries and then piled up on land surfaces, as well as there's a lot of fill materials around the city of New York where they were trying to fill in some of the more swampy areas that were in some of the parts of the city early on. Probably one of the better examples is in Central Park. That used to be a real swampy area. And in the mid-1800s, basically they brought in several million cubic yards of topsoil and filled in part of the swamps and such to create the landscapes of Central Park and such. So it's quite interesting in terms of trying to not only understand these different varieties of soils, but also in terms of soil survey, how would we actually map them across the landscape and portray them to users?
Can those kinds of things be applied to desert places? Lily in Phoenix wants to know about working the soil for backyard gardening in Phoenix.
In terms of adding materials to the soil?
Well, what would you do? Would you? How do you create a more fertile and loose soil for in a place like that? Do you just bring in man-made soils, or do you just can you convert the soil that's there into something that is amenable to growing things?
Well, if I could chime in on that one, I think probably the best rule of thumb for improving most soils for gardening is using a good quality organic material, whether it's a manure or a compost or something of that nature. When you get out into the desert areas, you also have to be thinking about whether the soils you're on have a salinity problem. A lot of dry soils, you know, the rainfall is not there to leach salts out, and they accumulate. So that would be the other big concern. But desert soils are very low in organic material and maybe high in salts, but I know there's a lot of commercial production in deserts with irrigation water that are extremely productive, so it depends.
Grant asks, is it true that, is it true that the nutritional content of soil has decreased so significantly over the years that one needs to eat a greater amount of fruits and vegetables to equal the nutritional content of the same food grown in the past?
Oh, that's a loaded question. intensive agriculture, of course, is going to be pulling nutrients out of the soil, and any plant does. And the difference is, you know, we're harvesting and taking those nutrients out of the field. So hence the requirement for fertilizers. My guess, now I'm not a nutritionist, and so bear with me here. I turn into a layman all of a sudden right here, but I would say that the nutrient content as far as what the soil's providing to the plant and the fruit or whatever it might be is very high these days because of the fertilizer applications and whatnot.
Now, a listener from North Carolina asked why there's so much red clay there. Is clay soil?
Shall I do this one, Mike?
Yeah, you lived in North Carolina.
Oh,
you might as well.
Yeah, that's right. Very close to there right now. I'm in Virginia. The red clay soil is, let's see, there were two questions there, and clay is a size fraction of soils. We think of mineral fractions of sand, silt, and clay is the finest. And oh, by the way, clay is usually a mineral that actually formed in the soil and usually did not come from the rock, by the way. So the red clay soils of North Carolina or whatever, Georgia, Virginia, and I'm thinking of the Piedmont, usually they dominate with kaolinite clays, and most people think of kaolins as potting clays, you know, making china or pottery, that sort of thing. Same sort of clay. And they're red because of different kinds of iron oxides in the soil, and redness mainly from this mineral called hematite. So they're a little difficult to work with because of the high clay content, so it's sort of moisture sensitive. You can't go out and till them up under very moist conditions. Their aeration might become a problem and that sort of thing. Those kinds of clays don't hold many nutrients, so they can acidify fairly quickly. So you have to manage them a little better, but they can be highly productive.
Let's take another call. We go to Robert from Milburn, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Always a pleasure to listen to you. I do it every morning. The idea of feeding earth to starving children and adults, I know it's been done, and to fill their bellies and make them feel as though they have been sated, but is there much in the way of nutrients in that for a human being to take in?
You or me, Mike?
Well, I wouldn't think there'd be very much nutrient value, basically, because the body can't break down soil particles. So maybe it would fill their stomach with materials, but obviously that doesn't have much nutritional value.
Yeah, you know, actually, I had heard about a group that was referred to, and I think this was back after maybe even the Civil War, maybe Depression, but they were called clay eaters in the Southeast,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they would do is try to fill their stomachs. And like Mike says, there's hardly any nutritional value there, other than whatever, let's say, calcium, magnesium, potassium might be attached to the clays, but that doesn't go very far as nutrition is concerned.
Justin from Park Slope writes, in Novella Carpenter's recent book, Farm City, she wrote about a neighbor's fig and mulberry trees growing in Oakland in soil full of lead. They had the fruit and the leaves tested, and while the leaves contained a lot of lead, the fruit was free of it and safe to eat. And he wants to know if other fruiting trees like tomatoes would behave this way and be safe to grow directly in the soil of New York City.
Well, that's a pretty common thing, especially like with lead, that if you're going to grow some sort of garden crop in it, leafy vegetables such as lettuce and such can accumulate a large amount of some of these trace elements. But the plants that where you eat the fruiting bodies, such as tomatoes or corn, oftentimes, you know, the trace elements may accumulate in the leafy material, but not in the fruit.
I would say anybody who's thinking that they may have the elevated levels of some of those trace elements, just get some testing done and be safe.
In other words, it could have worked in Oakland, but not necessarily in Brooklyn.
Well, probably anywhere it'd be the safest bet to have soil tests ran and then basically understand the content of lead or whatever trace elements you're concerned with. And then there's ways to remediate the soil. There's different things you can do, such as, you know, increasing pH or increasing organic content. But in certain cases, if there's concern, you probably either shouldn't use it for garden crops or replace the soil. Sometimes, you know, just growing grass or flowers might be the best use for some of these areas.
Let's go to Lilbet from Galdstone, is it?
Gladstone.
Gladstone. Well, they wrote Galdstone. Would you believe it?
No, thank you. My question is, can you please explain how the industrial farming is affecting the nutrients of the soil versus organic farming and how it's affecting our earth as a whole and our bodies, our health?
Well, I think, as I mentioned a minute ago, you know, our commercial farming. First of all, let me preface it by saying that you know, we need the production, we need the tonnage that's coming off of our commercial fields, and we're using nutrients out of the field, of course, and taking them out of the field, but we're also putting many of them back, and then it gets a little complicated because also. Fertilization acidifies the soil, so you have to put a little lime in and so on and so forth. So you have to pay attention and manage properly. Organic methods of farming are really great and requiring large amounts of organic matter, which we don't believe we have enough of to go around to go that route for commercial agriculture. I think what we have to also pay attention to is controlling runoff, controlling leaching of materials into the groundwater, and so that we can maintain and improve water quality through and still maintain a commercial production. And there's some things that are being done nowadays, like no-till, for example, that disturbs the soil less and improves infiltration over the long haul. And decreases the runoff and so on. So we're trying to get improve on the erosion control, the nutrient loss, and that sort of thing.
Let's go to Jeff from New York City. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the call.
Go ahead.
Question. You know, it seems like the previous questions and callers are covering this a little bit, but what is the effect of airborne pollutants? I've done some, you know, camping and fishing up in the Adirondacks, and remember acid rain and things like that. But You know, how do airborne pollutants affect the ground? Is the ground in some way scrubbing some of the pollutants out of the air? And, you know, is there a large difference between industrialized areas and large cities in comparison to the country? And how does that come back to affect the environment and us? Is it getting into the water tables, as you're saying, but, you know, is the ground actually susceptible to these airborne pollutants?
Well, I think you could look at it that soils form a buffer to the environment. Basically, as some of these airborne pollutants fall, you know, the soil has a large capability to absorb those pollutants. Some of the effects of acid rain are most drastic on basically, you know, soils that have a low capacity for absorbing it. They may be sandstones or whatever, that they don't have the capability or the nutrient content to help offset, say, the acidity that's been applied to them from the acid rain. But definitely in industrial areas, you know, the soil does accumulate these trace elements, and they don't typically move past, you know, the upper zones of the soil, and they can be fixed in a variety of chemical forms, some of which can be rendered available or not available depending on the nature of the soil properties.
A caller wants to know if soil samples collected from Mars are similar to some old terrestrial soils. Do you know?
I don't know about that one, Chris.
Well, let's see. I have a colleague that has done some work on that, and I'm trying to remember what he's told me. And I think that there are some similarities in that the red colors that you see in the Martian soils or sediments are iron oxide, similar to what we find here on Earth. Beyond that, I really don't know. But you know, as far as, you know, what kind of clays might be there, and I don't think the samplers are probably coming up with much clay because it would have blown so easily and disappeared. But we do know that some of the iron oxides are similar.
Well, we'll leave that for another show. A listener asks, agronomists sometimes recommend putting an electrical charge through the soil surrounding trees to promote root growth. Do you agree that that's a good idea?
I personally have no knowledge of whether that's beneficial or not.
I don't either.
we'll have to Google that one.
A couple of listeners have asked about terra preta, what it is and whether they can use ash from a barbecue to make it.
That's a very hot topic right now, so to speak. There's a lot of meetings going on about the values of terra preta and what the original description of terra preta is from some of the soils near to the Amazon River down in Brazil and such, is basically what an archaeologist might think of as middens. They're organic-rich, charcoal-rich soils you can also find down there in the Brazilian scenario pottery shards and that sort of thing. This terra preta or biochar is the term we're using. It can be of variable qualities. If you're making a charcoal-like product or biochar from a nutrient-poor substrate, then of course, once you char it, you're going to have nutrient-poor char. But there are other characteristics of the biochar that are very interesting. One is it's a very stable form of carbon, so once you put it in the soil, we have carbon sequestration going on.
Chris, we have to leave it there, unfortunately.
Okay.
We've run out of time. Chris Smith, Mike Wilson of the USDA, thank you so much for participating in today's Please Explain look at the nature of soil.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Sometimes parents can unconsciously choose a favorite child. On Monday's show, guest host Julie Burstein talks with a clinical psychologist about what the favorite child complex can do to both children and their parents. And then a child psychiatrist discusses the impact her mother's suicide when she was just 4 years old had on the rest of her life. Also, Sadie Jones on her novel Small Wars. It's the story of a marriage in crisis set against the backdrop of Britain's conflict in Cyprus in the 1950s. And jazz great Jimmy Heath will talk about his long career and many of the musical giants he met along the way, like Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Aida Sadakiani, Drew Katchen, and contributing producer Bonnie Lefebvre. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.